Welcome to Make Me Happy, the happiest happy hour you've ever been at. My name is Dr. Amy Koje.
And I'm Dr. Bob Nozick. Hi, Amy.
Happy New Year!
Right, and this, I think, is the first time that we've actually been able to officially use the title of doctor with your name.
I know. Let's mark it down in the history books.
I tell you, this is a red letter day.
What do you think it means now?
Well, it means now that when I tell you something, you're going to tell me you can't tell me that. I'm a doctor too.
It means I must know what I'm talking about.
Well, that's right. Isn't that what that means supposed to mean? You notice the qualifier supposed to in there.
Right.
So do you
well,
feel
anyways,
any, do you feel any different?
Let's talk about happiness and how we can spread it to the world.
Well, let's do that. Okay. So the article that I sent you this time is called How Your Friends' Friends Can Affect Your Mood. And basically, it's talking about social contagion.
Yeah. I think that this research is a key in helping our planet be a happier place.
Well, you know, it's a key at least to our understanding of the power of the social beings that we are. So other people really do influence us.
Absolutely, and it's been proven over and over and over again. And in this research, what's exciting about this research in particular is that it proves up to 3 degrees of separation you can influence to every single person you come into contact with in a day.
Well, that's right. It's not. The influence is not just you and your friend, but it's you and your friend and your friend's friend and your friend's friend's friend.
I think that's just miraculous, and we really have to take ownership of how we are contributing to the world through this.
Yeah, well, in a sense, that does mean we have a real responsibility, because it's not just to ourselves as far as the way we are, but the way we are influences other people on at least to the third degree.
I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Yeah, this particular study is based on what is called the Farmingham Heart Study, which is a study that has tracked factors influencing cardiovascular disease in Farmingham, Massachusetts. And this study has been going on since 1948.
Wow.
So it's really a long-term study. And the people, they used it because these people were available. And they had a ready-made group that they could work with.
Mm-hmm.
This was basically the work of Nicholas Christakis, who is a medical sociologist at Harvard Medical School.
Mm-hmm.
This really is his work, and as fascinating as it is, it also has other. There are many things about it we don't really understand yet, and I'm sure we will, but. You know, we've known for a long time that we are social animals, and that people with a good network of friends are happier. We've known this, but this gives us a little further insight, I think, into that.
Right. Well, not only did he talk about happiness being contagious up to 3 degrees of association, he also included obesity and smoking habits.
Well, that's right, and not surprisingly, the human animal doesn't really differentiate in how it operates whether things are going to be good or bad. So, in a sense, if you want to lose weight, you probably ought to try to associate more with people who eat healthy and are slim in their in how they their lives are. rather than it may mean at least if you maintain contact with people that are not slim and you want to be, you have to keep that in mind and work actively to keep that from influencing you.
Right. So people who are unhappy should probably step toward a social group that was a little bit more happier for them to receive the emotional contagion from that group.
That's right. And I say we've tended to know this, but now we have some science behind that knowledge that if you want to be a certain way, associate with people who are already that way.
Harvard research, nonetheless.
Nonetheless, that's right.
Well, without further ado, who is our guest today, Dr. Bob?
Well, our guest today, pleasure for me to introduce Barbara Becker Holstein, EDD, and she has been in private practice for 26 years in Long Beach, New Jersey. It's Long Branch, New Jersey, with her husband, Russell Mark Holstein, Ph.D. She is a leading positive psychologist, having published her first book in this discipline called The Enchanted Self, A Positive Therapy, and she published this in 1997, just about the time that positive psychology was born. She focuses on helping girls and women to be happy and live meaningful, purposeful lives by reclaiming their talents, strengths, and even lost potential. Dr. Holstein has a comprehensive website and blog for women at www.enchantedself.com, as well as a blog for girls, teachers, and moms at www.thetruthforgirls.com. She received her doctoral in education from Boston University and her BA degree from Barnard College. Her memberships include the American Psychological Association and the New Jersey Psychological Association, Women Networking, and Powerful You. Her article discussing the development of her unique positive psychology approach for women appeared in the 2006 winter issue of the Independent Practitioner, APA's Division 42nd Journal. Other articles of hers appear in hundreds of websites. In February 2008, her newest positive psychology book, the first fiction in the field of positive psychology, was published, called The Truth, I Am a Girl, I'm Smart, and I Know Everything, was released.
Love it.
Great title. You will fall in love with the 10-year-old girl in this book who has the courage and the wits to put into writing what every woman should remember about herself, her children, and the truths that really matter. And your daughter will identify and bond with the girl in a special way that will help her stay in touch with her strengths and potential. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Barbara Becker Holstein to the program. Are you there?
Yay,
yes, Barbara!
I am here, and I'm already intrigued and following your conversation about the third degree of connection, and just fascinated, and I really am excited to be on the show.
Well,
anytime
we're excited to have you.
Anytime we can talk to exciting, monumental people like yourself, we are in the field of happiness, we are excited too.
Well, great. We're going
to
send all this out. I'll be sending it later in New Jersey, and you'll be passing on some good vibes in California, am I right? Or
that's right.
Yep.
Exactly.
We're in the Bay Area here.
Yes.
So, Barbara, tell me, how did you begin your work in the field of positive psychology?
Well, it's an interesting tale and one of those serendipitous things. I had been doing psychoanalytically oriented work for 10 or 15 years and enjoying it very much, trudging along in it. But I had some concerns. Some had to do with the stance that typically the psychologist takes of being very quiet and non-demonstrative in the treatment room, and many other subtleties. Some were around women and their opportunities and the way they seem to handle childhood messages, that plagued them even with success stories coming as they grew up. Long story short, I did a research project on my own, case studies, with women not in my practice. I asked them a number of questions, many of which were about their childhood messages and how they affected them. And sure enough, they gave me back what I kind of anticipated, how negative messages in the family or giving priority to the boy in the family did indeed bring them down and affect them in some subtle ways as they grew up and as they married, etc. However, I have thrown in, just to almost cheer us up after the case study questions, another question about when do you feel most whole, when are you happiest, what really puts you in a good place within yourself? And there I discovered that the women all had fascinating stuff to tell me, but I had to pull it out of them. A lot of them didn't even know what I was asking till I reframed it 4, 5, 6 times. They had not thought about themselves in terms of what made them happy or made them feel whole. They really hadn't practiced accessing those memories, but with my help, they did. And the memories and what made them happy were wonderful. Everything from reading stories to their grandchildren, to gardening, to passing the torch at work if they were successful and mentoring others. Everybody had places where they were really integrated and feeling in a positive state, not like once a year, but, you know, within reason on a healthy basis. So as I interpreted my research, it became more and more striking to me that, yes, we can, you know, here was more research about the effects of negative messages, and that's important research. But what I was discovering is that women have this capacity for well-being and being happy that society and themselves was not reinforcing. None of us were helping each other access the happy states that we knew about, but we hadn't given ourselves permission to really talk about, find, reorganize in adult ways, etc. And that became for me a floating title across my kitchen as I was going over all my papers, The Enchanted Self. And
I love it.
Yes. And I just felt that was it. There was something magical and wholesome and mysterious, but in a positive way, about the best of ourselves, and we hadn't claimed it enough as a society and for sure as women. And that's the beginning of my work in positive psychology. I actually did all this about a year and a half before Dr. Seligman and other people even named the field. And I did it alone out there without 3 degrees of support. So,
well, that's,
and that
that's
ended up all being integrated into my first book, The Enchanted Self, A Positive Therapy.
So how do you use these memories in therapy?
Well, the trick about the memory use is to help people learn how to access their memories for what went right in their lives rather than what went wrong, and what parts of their memory banks suggest their talents, their interests, and even their lost potential, and learning how to find those parts without getting all engrossed in perhaps the dysfunctional aspects around those memories that may be kind of unpleasant or even need therapeutic work, to not get stuck at that level. Of course, you know, providing the correct therapy is necessary, but helping people understand that they can be an investigative person within their own psyche and sleuth out all sorts of their own talents, preferences, and strengths, that only they can be the best investigator because only they know all the nuances around something and how to pick through it and see if it can be used to reinvent it again, because often it has to be reinvented. I mean, if you were a top baton player, twirling a baton as a kid, or you were an archery star, or you loved to row a boat, you know, it may take an awful lot of gym work to get back to that, and you may want to go for it again, or you may want to go into a gym class that builds muscles or something sort of slightly related. But, you know, this is part of the whole mapping out of how you're going to reinvent your own positive side to yourself, which will ultimately bring you more positive states of well-being. You see, I originally didn't focus on the word happiness because happiness wasn't precise enough for me. I think that it's a good word, and I'm certainly going with the flow in today's market and today's world, but the sense of phrases like peace of mind or positive states of being and mind and body, these really represent a mood state, I think, a little more accurately than a word like happiness.
I agree with you 100%. Happiness is really charged, and most people think about happiness as a positive emotion, which is coming and going. And it sounds like to me what you're teaching women is to, you know, remove any social structures that have been imposed on them, such as the good woman stereotype, and empower them to come into confidence and acceptance of their true selves, in which case that would be a feeling more of eudaimonic or even charonic happiness.
Exactly.
Can you talk more about your experience with the good woman stereotype and how it's a boundary to happiness, or barrier to happiness for women?
You mean the stereotype that exhausts all of us and makes us feel guilty and like we've missed the boat every day? Is that?
Yes. Yep, that one, where you're supposed to listen empathetically,
right,
not speak your voice, and not have opinions and serve others and pretend like you don't exist.
Right, right. Well, I think that, you know, within it, going back to what you were talking about before with the 3 degrees and how we handle ourselves, I think that that concept didn't come out of the devil's pit. You know, I think within that was an intuitive knowledge that when we are graceful people in our speech, in our manner, when we try to let someone else have center stage if they seem to need it, and when we're gracious to guests and we don't embarrass, et cetera, that we're all happier. The problem is that, you know, everybody needs to get their bucket full, so that on one hand, we have to practice all the etiquette of being a very gracious, special, kind person, but at the same time, we have to take into account all of our own needs and all of our own replenishment, for sure. So I find with the women I work with, whether it could just be a workshop of upper-middle-class women, or it could be women in my practice with serious problems, it doesn't matter. They all are on empty or close to empty in terms of self-replenishment, that they haven't taken the time to refill themselves daily or weekly. I shouldn't say never. You know, they may have gone to a spa and that was wonderful those 3 days, or they do take yoga twice a week. I'm not saying it's flat. But permission, that sense that we're always nourishing ourselves and that is not destructive but essential, and that we always have to be clear about what our needs are. I mean, that doesn't mean embarrassing everybody because dessert is an hour late and we think we're a little low on sugar. I mean, obviously, it may be much smarter to bring your own little bag of a piece of chocolate, so no one ever knows that, you know, what your little hidden needs are. But yes, your needs have to be met, whether they're done quietly or on occasion. You have to say to a husband, "I'm sorry," or a boss, "You know, I've been handled inappropriately." Whatever it is, I mean, it goes from the sublime to, you know, very simple things. And it seems like as women we can never finish learning this. I certainly still, you know, have to practice and repractice it myself.
Yeah. So without acknowledging it, you think that happiness pretty much is not available.
I missed the first few words. I'm sorry.
Without acknowledging that this is the case that most women go through on a daily basis, you know, not filling up their needs, do you think that without acknowledging that this is important, happiness is not possible?
Well, I think that a steady sense of well-being is not possible. I mean, obviously, a woman pregnant with twins, dragging herself around, giving birth, may still have an ecstatic few hours when she first holds the twins. But if she's going to have a sense of well-being day after day with, in terms of raising those twins, she better have taken care of her needs and found how that family's going to, you know, how she will replenish herself within the family system, the community system, et cetera, in a thousand ways, or she'll not only be not happy, in quotes, but she'll become physically ill. I think something like twins is a good example because anybody that's raised one kid knows, you know anyone that had twins. I mean, you're sort of crawling on the ground for years. And yet we all think that's so cute and wonderful, and I wish I were a twin, and I'd love to have a twin, and it's sort of too bad I never had twins. But the amount of work to optimize something good in life is an awful lot of work.
Getting people, women, to go back and recall the pleasant memories, do you sometimes occasionally open a Pandora's box and find that very unpleasant memories are revealed, and what do you do about that?
Well, usually I don't. Well, there's two things. If it's a workshop or something like that, I give very careful guided instruction, and I'm right there with the women. If anybody looks pained or I see she's having trouble writing or processing, you know, I hop right in and take hold her hand and make sure that she just changes where she's going. She picks a different age range or a different set of opportunities, so we just go somewhere else. In my private practice, I usually take my clues from the client. Like, if she's talking about gardening, you know, I might ask her, how did you learn to garden? And I'll just be an investigator. You know, if she says, oh, well, I just read a few books and that's how I started, then I might just say something like, well, gee, you must learn quickly. I don't think I could start a garden just from reading. And maybe I'll hit payday. She might sort of smile and say, yeah, that's what my third grade teacher always said, that I was a fast learner when I was reading. And not, you know, and then that can lead to further discussion, which can open up some ways of not only building her morale, but finding some earlier talents. On the other hand, if my initial investigative questioning is showing a little dark cloud, you know, I might just leave the subject, or I might say this is something, you know, maybe sometime we'll explore this a little more, or tell her quite frankly what I was looking for, that I was really looking for some of her earlier talents. This doesn't seem the right road. Does she have any suggestions of something good she remembers, that, you know, where she was very successful in elementary school? And, you know, candor is a great honesty tool, and just take it so it's always in the best interests of the client.
Building on positive memory recollection, what are other tools that you would classify under positive therapy?
Okay. Well, there are several positive other tools that I use. One is memory, and one is the practice of positive states of being. So once you establish that something could work for you, now you've got to practice it. It's just like ordinary therapy in the sense that you discover some of the problem dynamics. Now you're in the middle part of it, and you've got to make some changes in practice. So if somebody has now ascertained that they absolutely love music and, you know, the whole variety of things, but maybe we've settled on operatic music as something that really brings her a lot of joy, the practice may be getting herself to four operas that winter, or it may be her building her CD library of certain operas. It may be taking a course in operatic music at the junior at the community college in her area. But the practice, because if she doesn't now integrate what uniquely makes her feel good, it will slide away again. It will not become a repetitive act. So now we move into that, you know, all sorts of normal things that go with practice, learning better negotiating skills, learning how to ask for certain things, learning how to reframe the story of our own lives so that when we feel a little bit down, we can recall that indeed we're the first generation, first woman not to be alcoholic, and what that means and so on. You know, some inner mantras that to practice so that they reinforce feeling good about oneself. So we're now into a multitude of techniques, and I think the easiest way that I've helped women get started, particularly who are not necessarily my clients, is I just want to make sure you can hear me.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Sometimes when I move, I'm afraid with the phone, even though it's a landline. But anyway, on my major website, enchantedself.com, there's a free download paper on the front page called The Seven Gateways to Happiness. And I outline the seven arenas we really have to focus on as women, and I give the background for each one, a mini case study, and an activity so that you can start to see the whole module of moving toward a positive state of being, repetitive type of thing. And we'll call it happiness for now. And the seven gateways, very, very briefly, include the first one, building on your self-esteem. The second one, expanding that into a full sense of the story of your own life, even generationally, and why it's important. The third gateway, learning to meet your needs and to negotiate. The fourth gateway, recognizing what gives us pleasure and how to refill ourselves and restore ourselves. The fifth gateway, learning how to mentor and be a mentor so that we get the information we need and we share what we need to. And the sixth gateway, joining rather than isolating, as you were saying before I got on the phone, in terms of friendship circles and churches and clubs and whatever is appropriate that brings us out of ourselves in positive ways rather than in ourselves. And the last gateway is the gateway that everybody has known for thousands of years before the word psychology existed, which is positive deeds or good positive action, good deeds. And that was so much research documenting that when we help others, we help ourselves. So I hope some of your listeners and, you know, will indeed download the paper and enjoy it.
Well, that's
Thank
great.
You.
It sounds like you've developed a fair number of positive psychology aspects that are even different from and separate from the standard approach.
Yes. Well, a lot of my work it overlaps in terms of building on strengths and potential and optimism and so on, and I think a lot of it is somewhat distinctive geared to a woman's psyche and the kind of spiral way we tend to think and interact so that, you know, a woman might start working on happiness through building her self-esteem, and the next thing she finds out is the way to do that is through some positive action in terms of charity work. You know, so she can leap to that gateway and then circle back to, say, building her own story a little stronger so she feels good about who she is.
You just brought up a good point about how first we acknowledge our strengths and become confident in our authenticity, but then we make the leap into developing meaning and purpose. Can you talk more about how you help women discover true meaning and purpose in life?
Well, I think for a lot of women, you know, genuine meaning and purpose does center still fundamentally about our relationships that we're able to make that we would call quote-unquote intimate, be it with our children, our parents, our friends, a spouse, or a significant other. Meaning and purpose are critical in these arenas, and when we mess them up, we really do suffer. Men are a little bit protected, I think, in that they're a little straighter in their thinking and can get absorbed in a project out of the intimate world. But I'm not saying men don't suffer just as much. I just think the ways we hit certain pitfalls are a little different. So for women, I really have to, I can't necessarily focus on just one arena, say a career, even if it's a wonderful one like medical school or something like that, because that woman may also have a lot of pain, say, around how she's relating to her mother, and we have to deal with that and build up skills and techniques and remove some of the wounds so that the sense of well-being can prosper, you know, across the board somewhat as she goes through medical school. And for a woman, it's just always a long story. You know, when most of her world is working pretty well, externally, internally in her own mind, externally as far as professionally, and also personally as far as her jobs and, her family and her intimate people, then that woman will feel a sense of purpose and have meaning to her life. It'll just flow out of her. And, you know, she's the kind of woman we love to meet for lunch because she's always so engaging and bright and cheery and a good listener and, you know, just so many wonderful things that come from feeling we're integrated in our various worlds. Now, of course, some women have a very focused purpose. Well, I'm that kind of woman. I mean, absolutely my family is critical to me, but I happen to be passionate about teaching concepts of positive psychology to women and girls, and that, I think, you know, even focuses a lot of my energy more than many women have the opportunity.
To teach positive psychology concepts to women and girls.
Right, right. And because of that focus, sometimes if I'm not feeling well or I've had a mini tiff with my husband or something, I get a little leverage of some free points in there to still feel pretty good. But, you know, if things go down too much in any one of the of a woman's worlds, then she does have to kind of leverage everything up again so that she can really go at full tilt with whatever, whether she has one passion, as I'm quite directed in one thing, or whether she has many things.
I see.
You seem to be kind of a specialist in the female area, the woman's area, and I'm wondering, do you see men as well in therapy, and do men have an enchanted self?
Well, as my husband says, men have an enhanced self. They're not so crazy. Not so crazy about that term, enchanted self. It doesn't have enough of a ring of testosterone to it, quite frankly. But, yeah, I have seen men my entire career. You know, always the percentage of men has been lower than women, I think, for a lot of clinicians. But I've had men of every age and type, and I work pretty much the same way, which is basically a psychodynamically oriented way with a positive psychology overlay. And I remember one man I saw who was coming out of a divorce and a loss of a job and then a different job. And ultimately what really, really helped him was permission for him, from me, to go back to school. He had never actually even graduated high school, though he had been very successful, to feel comfortable going back to college, skipping right out of high school, you know, back into a junior community college, and developing many of his talents and interests through a lot of the work we did. And I'm sure any good therapist would have helped him through the gateways he needed to go through, but I think the positive psychology overlay I gave to it just made it fun and exciting, and he felt very special about himself, even with all the, you know, difficult work he was doing to grow through some changes.
Great. Well, I think it's definitely hard to only help women and only help men, because there's just so many people out there who need well-being.
Right.
My next question is about positive therapy in specific incidences. Like, for instance, with someone who has extreme anxiety, or and another incident would be, like, let's say a spouse has a long-term affair. Can you talk about how you would address this with positive therapy?
Well, actually, first of all, with both of those examples, the acute anxiety, you want to tone that down a bit. That could mean everything from, you know, a psychiatric consult where the person is getting some medication, at least temporarily, to maybe some cognitive or meditative work or visualizations, other things that are going to help him or her quiet so that they're available to even work on their stuff. So in both of those cases, the only thing that would probably make clear that I'm a positive psychologist in the first few interviews would be that I still would be interviewing to look for some of the bright spots in their lives and some of the times when they felt most successful and displayed some of their talents and their potential, or at least experienced them in their heads. And I might explain that I hope to use some of that material later, or I might not. If the person's really anxious, I'm not going to burden that person with anything extra in the beginning. But in both of those cases, I would be waiting in a timely manner to work on some of the positive parts of themselves when it was really appropriate. A person dealing with a marital affair may be deciding whether to finally move ahead toward a divorce, or she or he may be trying to come to grips with accepting the affair and staying in the marriage. So there might just be so much didactic work to do that, you know, other things do have to be backburnered for a little while. So, again, one of the things, when I wrote The Enchanted Self of Positive Therapy, I make clear again and again in the book, even though the case studies are basically from my orientation, that whatever your training, you can take the overlay of positive psychology techniques and have them available in your treatment room, and it's your timing. And you're going to know that best as to how to fit them in.
Well, I can't wait any longer. I've been really eager to ask you about your novel, The Truth, I'm a Girl, I'm Smart, and I Know Everything About, and I Know Everything. And I'd like to know, what's the story behind that and the backstory?
Well, I'm sure glad you couldn't wait any longer, because I couldn't wait any longer either. This is, she is really, really my baby, you know. Well, the story behind it is 15 years of positive psychology work, pretty much total, because even my first book took two or three years before it actually got published. And I wanted a way. Now, how can I teach not only some of the attitudes and self-talk that we have in our heads to stay a vital, integrated person who is enough in love with her or himself to be happy? How can I do it? You know, I wrote a clinical book. It's in a lot of colleges. It's available around the world. People buy it. That's great. I wrote two other books. One was a story book, Recipes for Enchantment, The Secret Ingredient is You. I even wrote my own spiritual memoir called Delight, D-E-L-I-G-H-T. Hmm. But, you know, I knew there was something missing. And this girl started to appear in a rough draft of a book that never got published. She originally appeared as a rough draft speaking to me as a grown-up woman and a clinician, and we were talking about each of the seven gateways to happiness. And it was a wonderful idea, and, you know, one of those great rough drafts that may or may not ever reemerge. But I decided, why does she have to talk to me? Let me get out of the way. Let this girl just be a 10 to 11-year-old girl who is within the normal range. Yes, she is a little bit more sunny Brook Farm in the sense of a optimistic attitude than perhaps totally average, a little above average in her attitude, but plenty of family problems, plenty of issues, and she let her, you know, I'm saying to myself, let her emerge and let's see what she's going to do. And so I started writing at night things that she wanted to say. And what happens with people writing fiction, I've heard this again and again, is the character starts to take over and tell you things that have to be said. And she did that. You know, some of the first entries I just threw out, and she kept getting a clearer and clearer sense. And pretty soon I knew that we were going to cover 3 years or two, trying to remember now, like 2 years of grammar school, and we were definitely going to cover this crush she had on a boy, because that's so much essential girl woman stuff, how we start to have relationship feelings toward men. You know, we can't get away from it. Even the girl who ends up going a gay route has fascination and flirtations with girls. You know, whatever's emerging, this material is so hot and so clear and so important that I felt it was one of the themes that had to be in the book. And usually we never fall in love and really marry the person we have a crush on when we're 11. But what do we do with that? And so she has this wonderful way that she eventually works herself into some acceptance of the crush. One of the things that really helps her is that Paul, who is the fellow she has a crush on, ends up 4 inches shorter than she. And, of course, body image things become very relevant at 10, 11, 12, and it's just not working, you know. But whether it works for one girl and it doesn't work for another, all of the themes that I put in the book open the door to conversation between mother and daughter, teacher and children, guidance counselor, psychologist, and you don't have to have the same thing happen to you. I mean, she wants to be a dancer, but she's kind of awkward. She really wants to trip the girl that is the best dancer. we all want it to kind of you know, get rid of some kid when we were in the fourth, fifth, or sixth grades. And again, conversation, discussion, growth opportunity. And what really made it a novel rather than some sort of work material or workbook in positive psychology is that it turned out this whole story emerged where she loves Nancy Drew, she loves to solve mysteries, and she finally figures out with the help of a locket that her aunt gives her as a birthday gift. I don't want to give it away because I want everyone to read the book, and it's a very simple book in terms of length. It probably takes an adult 50 minutes and a girl maybe an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours to read it. The locket has a way of giving her a solution of how she's going to hold on to her own identity as she goes into early adolescence. And that is what is scaring her the most. You know, she sees these older girls, and they're all gossiping, and they're all developing, and they're all racing around like maniacs. And how is she going to hold on to her own integrity as she has to move through the storm of adolescence? And the book ends with her making a solution, and then it's followed by many questions that the girl can use in her own journaling, or mother and daughter can use to discuss, or teacher, etc. And I was just going to mention that a very bright older man, well, in my age range and well into late middle age, anyway, he read the book and he said to me, "Was there more to that book than I thought there was going to be? Because it got me thinking on so many levels." And my response to him, yes, there is. You know, it is designed to reawaken parts of yourself you've walled off in positive ways, and also to give a girl who's reading it just a great sense of, wow, I loved identifying with this girl, and I'm gonna be the best I can be as I get older, of course, just like she was. So that's how the book began. I'll just read you the things she promises to do when she grows up, and you'll see how they relate to counseling and the whole field of therapy as we know it, without having to say it in strong words.
Great.
Things I promise to do when I grow up. I'll travel a lot. I won't look away when my kids are asking me tough questions. I'll answer truthfully. I won't swear. I won't get into silly fights with my husband. I'll have fun with my kids and laugh a lot. I'll remember me, and that's the truth.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Very inspiring.
Thank you.
And I know that with women, it's really easy to lose that identity, so it's great to tell a story from such a young age that's actually important.
Right, right. I actually came out with an edition for women that is still available on Amazon. Both, of course, this is available on Amazon, and I hope some of the people who listen to the show will pop onto Amazon and order it. It's only $6.95. But you know what I found with the adult woman's version, even though I had an introduction and questions totally geared to the a woman's spirit, is I don't think it had as much meaning to read it for themselves as to read it more in conjunction with a daughter or a neighbor or a cousin or a granddaughter. That, again, when we're helping someone else, it somehow gives us an easier permission to look back at ourselves, too.
Definitely. Can you talk more about the part of the title that says, "I know everything"?
Well, yes. Now, I don't mean that, you know, like the Spitfire negative child is just a brat. What I meant by that is a wisdom that really kids have between, we know through research that girls have tremendous capacities and wisdom and energy between 9 and 11, and Emily Hancock's early research, well, it's now almost 20 years ago, on The Girl Within, you know, that they just know so much, and they recognize when adults are fibbing, they recognize when they're not getting the whole story, they recognize when their parents are fighting over meaningless material, not real material. But, you know, kids usually never get any credit for that. And so I do want to confirm to kids, you're on the right track. Even though your mother and father may be the boss, and even though you can't confront them that what they're fighting about is ridiculous in a particular family, you know, you may just have to keep your mouth shut, I don't want you to feel like you don't have real wisdom. You really do, and hold on to it.
Yeah. You know, Barbara, you haven't said this specifically, but there seems to me to be a kind of an overlaying hint at spirituality in your work, and I'm wondering if I've caught something or if that's not the case.
An overlaying level of spirituality in my work? I think that's what you said?
Yes.
I think for sure. I really do believe that we have, you know, I mean, that would take a whole nother hour to get into, but, you know, that we're here for purpose and for growth, and that treating children humanely and helping them develop is critical. The way we talk, the way we handle ourselves, the way we treat a pet, you know, no matter where you turn. And at least as adults, we should acknowledge it. You know, for example, this girl has a cousin who comes to visit overnight, and he swears a lot. And, you know, her parents just kind of coddle the cousin, which may be appropriate. He's a visitor. But she knows that he's not very nice. And it's the truth. And somehow, some way, it, you know, we need to be acknowledged that we've seen the light. We don't always behave as if we've seen the light, but you know, we recognize a lot of stuff. I myself, you know, I consider myself very spiritual. In my book, Delight, what I did was I grew up a very secular Jew. I took an opportunity and went to some very religious experiences through Judaism that I never had a chance to experience. For example, in Judaism, religious, like, quote-unquote religious, that's just a word used like happiness, religious Jewish people observe the Sabbath just as Christians did for hundreds of years, a full Sabbath. You know, you didn't even take your horse and buggy out if you were a Christian 200 years ago on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And had an opportunity to live with a family and experience a whole day of rest and what that feels like, and, you know, many experiences that most people don't get to do, not because we can't, but because we forget them and we don't build them into our lives in the American culture, which personally, I believe, is a loss for everybody, regardless of religion. Some of the more wholesome aspects of the sanctuary that the good book has holds, so to speak. So you're right, but I you know, I don't think we want to probably say much more than that at the moment.
Okay.
But we can say that your spiritual, your spirituality definitely increases your own well-being and happiness.
I think it does. I think that those people who really believe that you're being protected, whether it's through angels or God or however you believe it, through Reiki, through positive energies coming in from the somehow from the universe, the great divine, feel safer and feel more at ease, less at risk. Not that we don't all become somewhat frantic when we're in a foxhole.
Well, on that note, can you please give our listeners your contact information and website in case they'd like to follow up with you?
Absolutely. Okay, so it's Dr. Barbara Becker Holstein, and it's www.enchantedself.com. The book I'm most eager for you to read and share with your daughter, granddaughter, neighbor at the moment is The Truth. I'm a girl, I'm smart, and I know everything. It's available on my own websites and, of course, on Amazon. I would encourage you to buy it through Amazon. And I also will re-mention my first book, The Enchanted Self, A Positive Therapy, which also is on Amazon. And I'm available. I'm in New Jersey, and I can be reached. The office telephone number, 732-571-1200. I think that's probably enough information.
Thank you so much, Barbara. We always invite our guests to join us in a fit of laughter as we come to conclusion in our show. Would you like to join us?
Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much. You've been a wonderful, wonderful guest, and we look forward to future relating with you, Dr. Barbara. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Made my day. Bye-bye.
We've never been introduced.
You wouldn't recognize me in an elevator.
We enjoy different sports.
But if you ever need it, I will give you my blood.
Your blood could save a life. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-GIVE-LIFE or visit givelife.org today.
Smoke just one brand, 'cause I get mine secondhand.
The facts are in. Secondhand smoke causes lung cancer in non-smokers. Remember, it's your life.
Ours too.
Secondhand smoke.
That's secondhand smoke.
It'll make you choke. Well, that's secondhand smoke.
Help others breathe a little easier. This message from Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights.
We talk about water all the time. We say our mouths water and we don't want to get into hot water. And blood is thicker than water and you can't mix oil and water. It's not all talk. We're even made of water. But what do you really know about your tap water? Do you know where it comes from or what's in it? Chances are you don't. But now you can. Your water supplier will soon be sending you a short new report about your drinking water. Look for it. And when you get it, read it, because this report really holds water. Learn more by calling your water supplier or 1-877-EPA-WATER.
I don't smoke just one brand, 'cause I get mine secondhand.
The facts are in. Secondhand smoke causes lung cancer in non-smokers. Remember, it's your life.
Ours too.
Secondhand smoke.
That's secondhand smoke.
It'll make you choke. Well, that's secondhand smoke.
Help others breathe a little easier. This message from Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights.